Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. All things political coming up this hour, and we have much on the plate. We'll be talking about the federal appeals court ruling that President Donald Trump's immigration order will remain suspended, which preserves the Washington federal judge Robart's offer to temporarily halt the ban. Robert, that should be his name. The Justice Department lawyers have until 6 o'clock today to respond. We will talk about that at some length during the course of this hour. Also, Vice President Pence is going to take on the issue of voter fraud. Interesting article in today's New York Times. Donald Trump was not fully briefed on the executive order that he signed giving Stephen Bannon a National Security Council seat. Reince Priebus has now created, according to this article, a 10-point checklist for the release of any new initiatives that include sign-off from the Communications Department and the White House staff secretary. What do U.S. allies think about the president? And the markets are still very strong. We'll talk about why that is the case. The Betsy DeVos nomination, will she be confirmed? It's looking likely at this point in time, and that could happen sometime today or tomorrow. Just a few of the issues we'll be discussing this hour, and our guest is Heather McGee, president of the public policy organization Demos. She is a frequent guest on Meet the Press and Hardball and Real Time with Bill Maher. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, and The Hill, among other outlets, and she is one of the Root's 23 black political pundits. She co-chaired a task force with Americans for Financial Reform that helped shape key provisions of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. We'll talk some about that. That's also in the news. But we will start with this federal appeals court ruling that preserved the Washington federal judge's order to temporarily halt this ban. And in case you missed the comments, these are comments from the Attorney General of the state of Washington, who late on Friday night said this about the judge's decision.
It's obviously a historic decision and an important one for the rule of law and for the people of the state of Washington and the people of our country. I said from the beginning, it is not the loudest voice that prevails in a courtroom. It's the Constitution. And that's what we heard from Judge Robart today. We're a nation of laws. It is absolutely my expectation that the federal government will honor this ruling by this judge today. Not everybody may like this decision. I'm certain the president will not like this decision. But it is his job. It is his responsibility. It is his obligation as our president to honor it. And I will make sure he does.
And Mike Pence, the vice president, had these comments on the executive order.
We're very confident the president's operating within his authority as president, both under the Constitution and under clear statutory law. That's what's so frustrating about the decision.
We'll be welcoming phone calls for Heather during the course of this hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Hello, Heather. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
So what did you make of Judge Robart's decision, and what do you make of the path forward, Heather?
Well, I think that the way that the Trump administration, and really as we now know, Steve Bannon and Jeff Sessions, moved to create really fulfilling a campaign promise of a Muslim ban, in the words of President Trump during the campaign and since then, is likely unconstitutional in its religious discrimination and illegal in the way that it was borne out. And most importantly, and you've seen this across the country with the amazing outpouring of people, many of whom who have never protested before, saying, wait a second, the idea that this country, the country of the Statue of Liberty, would not be a country that would accept refugees who have been vetted, who have been given visas, where international students would be barred from our shores, and that, frankly, one man could sort of unilaterally, without even letting, you know, the agencies that needed to carry it out, be the one to say, we don't want you here, smacked as deeply un-American at its core. And so there has been a lot of pushback A lot of people saying, you know what, I actually can't sit on the sidelines for this. A lot of young volunteer lawyers who have gone and set up shop in the airports. And then now this very important ruling from a Republican appointee, from George W. Bush's federal court appointee.
Mm-hmm. You're having a few Republicans who are expressing some concern. Mitch McConnell saying we all get disappointed from time to time at the outcome in courts on things we care about. He went on to say, I think it best to avoid criticizing judges individually. We can't shut travel down, and we certainly don't want Muslim allies who have fought with us in countries overseas to not be able to travel to the U.S. We need to be careful about this.
Yes, and that's exactly what this whole process has not been. Sadly, I wish we could say that we're surprised that Trump is attacking the validity and kind of integrity of a judge who disagrees with him. But we already saw that in the campaign when he said that a judge who was presiding over the case that he ended up settling for $25 million, the fraud case of Trump University, he said that he could not be partial because he was of Mexican heritage. And today we are, you know, realizing that over the weekend, the president of the United States called a federal judge a so-called judge. This actually is part of a systematic approach to undermining the illegitimacy of any institution of our great nation. That does not agree with Donald Trump. It is law and order by the rule of Donald Trump, and that should terrify every American of every ideological stripe.
What about the authority? Many have said, I'm sure you know, Heather, that the president has a great deal of authority, executive leeway over immigration.
The president does have leeway over executive over immigration, and we saw that with President Obama's DACA program, for example, to deprioritize you know, young people who had been brought here by their parents, the Dreamers. But what he doesn't have the authority to do is violate the Constitution, to discriminate and create a religious test, as it appears that he has done. And also to unilaterally void a refugee program that has, you know, many different international and national commitments for the country.
No matter which way the court, and I would assume this will go to the Supreme Court eventually, rules on this, there's obviously going to have to be some system put in place so you don't have the chaos, really, that we saw last weekend.
Absolutely. The president, without really doing any investigation, decided that the system that we currently have in place for vetting visa holders and refugees is not sufficient. And so he decided to basically, you know, sort of throw a bomb into the whole system in order to create some sort of pause for investigation. That's exactly the wrong way to go about it. You had, in the course of just one day, years of goodwill across the world that we had sort of scraped our way back to after, frankly, putting into motion much of the conflict in the Middle East with the misguided war in Iraq that we're seeing now. And it is going to take a long time for us to get that back, and that is so much a part of what actually keeps us safe. Is the fact that we have allies, including in the Muslim world, the fact that our troops who are still overseas can count on Arabic translators, and the fact that we have the moral authority of this nation to still be a place that people, even when they're in the most war-torn and desperate circumstances, aspire to come and become citizens of this country.
Many in the administration have pointed to those seven countries where there will be a temporary ban as countries that were cited by the Obama administration as ones that should cause us concern because of terrorist groups within those countries. The Obama administration has been cited many times here as giving precedent for what's been happening. Is that fair to look at what that administration did, Heather?
Well, there are a couple of different reasons why it's really not fair. First of all, this order was so far-ranging and sweeping, gathering in dual nationals, international students, all refugees, new immigrants, first green card holders, still business travelers. It's really quite unprecedented in its scope and, frankly, in the sloppiness of its drafting. It's very clear that this did not go through the proper channel, which is actually, I think, going to, in the end, be its downfall because it was so shoddily drafted. It was also in the instance of the Obama administration in response to a clear and present danger, as opposed to, frankly, a response to xenophobia and a lot of scaremongering that worked to get the president into office, but cannot work as a matter of public policy going forward.
Heather, do you see this as ultimately going to the Supreme Court? And with this eight members of the Supreme Court, what happens if it's an anticipated 4-4?
I do think that it is likely to end up in front of the Supreme Court, but I don't think it's a given that it will be a 4-4 split. This is not something, as your quote from Mitch McConnell has shown, as the fact that even now Vice President Mike Pence tweeted last year that the idea of a Muslim ban was unconstitutional and un-American. This is not an issue that is going to cut across normal partisan lines, as the George W. Bush appointee who recently stayed the ban showed. I think you're going to see that a majority of the justices, even those who are typically more conservative, will say that there is a rule of law and a constitution around discrimination when it comes to religion and when it comes to an earlier 1965 Immigration Act that actually is the standard here, that is not about left or right, but is more about right or wrong.
We're going to try and get you on a better phone line. You're a little hard to hear, and then we'll welcome phone calls for you. We're talking to Heather McGee. This is All Things Political. We have a number of issues to talk about this hour with Heather, who is president of the public policy organization DEMOS, and she's been with us before, and she'll be with you in your phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have a number of other issues to explore with Heather, but we'll start taking a couple of your phone calls now, starting with Lee in Williams Bay. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Lee.
Well, according to the New York Times, which I read every day, 15 of the 21 perpetrators of the 9/11 attack were from Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And why isn't Saudi Arabia on the list that Trump, set out? Does this exclusion of Saudi Arabia have anything to do with Trump's business ventures with the Saudis? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Lee. Thanks for calling.
Lee, thanks for calling, and thanks for that question. That's a really good point. I'm glad you've raised it. We still have not seen Donald Trump or his children either divest from, in the case of Donald Trump, so that he's not actually profiting from the White House, or his children actually resign as some of them said that they would. And so there's a lot of reason to be very suspicious, in fact, of the conflict of interest. Is this president working for the American people, or is he following sort of the creed that has guided his career, which is making more money for the Trump empire? And people were very quick to note that the list of countries did not include any of the countries where the Trump brand is in effect, and where he has deals in the past and possibly in the future. And also, most importantly, didn't include the countries where terrorists have come from and spilled blood on American soil. This idea that refugees in the, obviously in Europe, we have seen people who have come in their, much more open border system, have carried out individual attacks and heinous attacks. But that has not been the history here in the United States, and that's partly because of how, frankly, how few refugees we are taking in, particularly from Syria, the site of the great refugee crisis of this moment, and because of how thoroughly we do already vet refugees. I would just also like to add one note, is that we are seeing a disturbing sign that, in fact, the much more prevalent case of white supremacist and white nationalist domestic terror groups who have killed many more people than any refugees, which the number is zero, have been deprioritized and taken off of the list of who should be sort of monitored and focused on from this administration, which is no surprise, given that Steve Bannon's Breitbart News is a platform for the new white nationalism. But that should all be really terrifying to us all.
There certainly wasn't very much said about the horrible massacre in Quebec.
Exactly, because that does not fit the right-wing narrative that it is Muslims who are killing, white people, right? White Christians. In fact, this was a young white man who was really, radicalized and killed many people in Quebec at a mosque. And it's very upsetting that the president had time to talk about a canceled speech at UC Berkeley because it fit his ideology, but he couldn't extend a hand or even a tweet about that act of terror just above our borders. Mm.
The New York Times had an interesting piece I'm sure you've read this morning about what's going on inside the White House, interviews with lots of government officials, congressional aides, former staff members. And the article says this, a president determined to go big but increasingly frustrated by the efforts of his small team to contain the backlash that he has received. From now on, Donald Trump will be looped in on the drafting of executive orders much earlier in the process. Reince Priebus created a 10-point checklist for the release of any new initiatives. I'm wondering, evidently the president tweeted today that he has instructed Homeland Security now, considering the fact that the ban has been lifted, to check people coming into our country very, very carefully. Do you know what he means by that?
No, and neither does he. It's really, it's very sad and it's frustrating and it's scary because, honestly, I am sympathetic to many people who cast a ballot for Donald Trump in November because of his message about jobs, because he said that he would bring jobs back to the country, because he said that he would take on a system where Washington elites had not been forceful enough in fighting to keep good jobs in America. I couldn't agree more with that statement and with the frustration, frankly, with, the current political system where too much money in our political system has diverted the attention of our policymakers away from the concerns of working and middle-class families. But one out of four Trump voters, according to exit polls, thought that he was unfit for office. That's his own voters. Two out of three disagreed with major parts of his policy agenda. And now we are seeing that this man has reached negative approval numbers faster than any other president in history. 2 weeks in, he is already at 51% of the country disagreeing strongly with the direction he is taking the country. And part of it is because he simply was not ready and would never really, I don't think, be ready to take on the enormity of the task of actually leading the greatest nation on the earth. And that article was very disturbing because it really showed kind of a gang of a handful of men kind of having way more power, dark rooms in the White House because it's not fully staffed. This is a time of major challenges for the United States, whether it's global climate change, the refugee crisis, economic inequality, nuclear threat always around the corner. And the idea that someone whose interests and capabilities are not up to the job is the one calling the shots and is not even reading his own executive orders is very scary.
Do you imagine that he will, and he campaigned on this heavily and won the election because of it, that he will soon come up with substantial plan to put people who are not working back to work with a major infrastructure program or be able to successfully bring jobs back to the United States. That would make a lot of people happy, Heather.
It most certainly would, and for the sake of the country, I hope that he can. What we've seen so far, unfortunately, is a betrayal of the promise to drain the swamp, a betrayal of the promise to stand up for the little guy. And I can be very specific about this. I mean, I think we were all shocked after seeing Trump as a candidate have campaign ads railing against government and against they call it government Sachs, against Goldman Sachs, against Hillary Clinton's undisclosed Goldman Sachs speeches, and against a government run by Goldman Sachs folks. And there are three members of his close circle who are from Goldman Sachs or other Wall Street firms. You've got the big oil CEO, the CEO of Exxon, being put in place, who's a very close ally of Russia, into place as a Secretary of State. That doesn't sound like changing who's in power on behalf of the working and middle class. We've already seen signs of a tax plan that would mean essentially no more taxes for Trump children, getting rid of the estate tax, lowering the tax on wealth so that more of the tax burden falls on people who work for a living. We've seen him wanting to do little things like change the rule, stop the Obama-era rule that is around retirement security, which you would think is very simple and should already have been in place. The idea that when someone is a retirement broker and advisor, they should sell you a product that's in your best interest, not in their own financial interest. It's something called the fiduciary rule in Dodd-Frank. And on Friday, he signed an order saying that he would try to erode that rule. These are the kinds of broken promises that make it very unlikely that when it comes to actually benefiting the people he made positive promises for, he's going to be able to carry out those. We've already seen that he has made good on the promises that would harm people, and that's where we stand right now. It's still looking for where the benefit will be for working people to balance any kind of ledger with the harms that have already happened to communities that he's targeted.
Heather McGee is our guest, and it's All Things Political you're listening to. We go next to Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I want to say, like, Timothy McVeigh was part of this the groups that are no longer being scrutinized, and I imagine, you know, anyway. My point is that Mr. Trump has a long history of making statements that are not truthful, like the fact that his movement is the largest movement in the history of the world, or that the inauguration was attended by more people than any other one, or this extreme vetting was just a marketing tool, because I listened to a program from the people who are actually working in the State Department and who are doing the vetting, and what's involved they're thoroughly vetted, and the president has made it seem like, in a tweet, bad guys flooding into country, bad, and things like that, which are just totally ridiculous. They're not true at all. You don't just march into this country, you know, willy-nilly. And we have troops in Iraq, so that's also troubling. And, you know, I think that this president, and it's not, I don't think it's a coincidence. I think that if you look into Steve Bannon's worldview, that this is part of their worldview, to create chaos in all the norms of our democratic country, like, you know, calling into question whether a so-called judge and all these things, calling into question the legitimacy of our electoral process. This is a strategy by Steve Bannon to create destruction, and then they're going to rebuild something after this destruction, although I don't know what that would be.
Heather.
I really appreciate that comment. It's very thoughtful. If your readers haven't seen a new article out today by Jamel Bouie, B-O-U-I-E, in Slate online, they really should. The article explains how we are actually now at a point where white nationalists are running our government. and talks about the ideological backgrounds and programs of Steve Bannon, Jeff Sessions, Steve Miller, Richard Spencer, the now infamous neo-Nazi who was punched at a protest. And it becomes clearer exactly what program the people who are writing the orders that the president is not fully reading before he signs, apparently, the program that they have and the vision that they have for America, which is one in which the country is made generous and strong, but only for white people. And I don't think we have to settle for that. I think that there is a lot of widespread and understandable economic anxiety, frankly, no more so than among, working class immigrants and people of color and single women and young people who are drowning in debt and stuck in entry level jobs. The economic pain that we are talking about is quite widespread among all of Americans, all but the very wealthiest. So the idea that we have to build walls internally here in the country and exclude and try to change the color and makeup of this country in order to have middle-class prosperity for all, it's a false choice. And I don't actually think that most of the people who voted for Donald Trump, which again is still millions fewer than voted against him, actually signed up for that program. But we have got, frankly, to have a real truth-telling in this country about the extent of our economic pain, the fact that there are policies that the government under Democrats and Republicans have refused to actually move in terms of paid family leave, a higher minimum wage, debt-free college for all, massive investment in mass transit and infrastructure that isn't done with, you know, tolls for everybody, but is actually done using the power of the government to spend and invest in our own country. If the current conservative and Republican Party were in charge after the war, you know, we would never have the national highway system. There is this sense that we simply can't invest in our own country and that we can't spread the prosperity of this country to all who are willing to work for it. And I think that is a minority position that is really only held by, frankly, a cabal of folks who are in the White House trying to impose their vision on the rest of this great country.
Heather, who do you think would best serve the DNC to present an alternative future for the country that you just outlined?
That's a really great question. I think a lot of people are really focused on this race, not only because of the policy ideas could be out there, but also to reanimate the Democratic Party as a home for grassroots activists. I mean, we are seeing a moment of engagement like, frankly, we've never seen, certainly not in my lifetime, where people are saying, I actually can't sit on the sidelines anymore. There have been, you know, three times as many phone calls to the congressional switchboard as there ever have been before. And a question about whether or not the Democratic Party is going to provide the home for everyday grassroots engagement. And the only one of the candidates that I have personally seen really take that ethos and live it out is Keith Ellison, who, even though he's in a pretty safe seat in Congress, has always had a very grassroots program of knocking on doors, of engaging, you know, full year round with organizing and talking to his constituents, spending, you know, very little money on paid advertisements and television, which just goes to the, you know, lines the pockets of media buyers and media companies, but rather spends that money to create events and engagement for people in his community. And so I think his vision is to bring that kind of engagement to the Democratic Party. And if so, then I think that's the most encouraging vision that I've seen.
More phone calls. Our number there, lines open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. Andrea Imanakwa, hi.
Good morning or afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question. If I, as a ordinary citizen, insulted a judge, let alone two judges, who were to make a decision on my action, wouldn't I be in contempt of court? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Andrea.
I'm not a criminal or civil procedure expert, but as far as I understand, if you were standing in court and insulted the judge would most likely hold you in contempt of court. Some people might say this is just Donald Trump being hot-tempered, and we all knew that he was hot-tempered, and that's okay. But I'm actually more concerned that it's part of a concerted campaign to delegitimate every other branch of government that could hold the presidency accountable. We do not have a king or an emperor in the United States, and the concern is that between his war on the media, him saying, his advisor saying literally that the media is the opposition party, him challenging basic facts, his ability to lie and to have his press secretary lie to the press and feel comfortable that the right-wing media machine that has sort of really gone off the rails over the past handful of years will sort of absorb the lies and make them part of a sort of new alternative truth and delegitimate the media itself is very scary. It is an essential step towards authoritarianism, which honestly, again, I just have to say that I don't think any American actually thought that they were voting for.
Heather, you mentioned the number of phone calls that were being handled by the switchboard in the Capitol, mm-hmm. double what they usually are. A lot of those calls, it's my understanding, have come in mostly asking people to vote against Betsy DeVos for Secretary mm-hmm. of Education. That vote could come today, I understand, or tomorrow. Why is there so much opposition to that? And do you see a third Republican who could make her nomination history, or do you think it will go through?
That is a really good question. It has been really amazing to see the amount of grassroots energy against a thoroughly unqualified and ideological, basically billionaire campaign donor to run the nation's education system. I think part of why that, as compared to, for example, the fast food CEO who makes in an industry where they make 1,000 times more than the average employee as CEOs, who doesn't like the minimum wage and thinks robots would be better than workers. Andrew Putzer, right? The idea that mm-hmm. he could be a labor secretary, that should be just as offensive to all of us as the unqualified education secretary. I think people who maybe are not very closely watching politics normally in their lives understand that education affects them, their family, and their children. And when it was clear just how unqualified and how disrespectful of the public school system that serves the vast majority of young people in this country, including, the public college system and community colleges, it became clear that this was just a bridge too far. So we've already seen two profiles in Courage with two Republican women saying that she does not meet the test. There is a possibility that a Republican from North Carolina or from Ohio might be on the fence. I've heard that that is where there's been a lot of organizing right now to and some openings. But I think it is likely that absent a lot more pressure to Republican senators, we won't have another Republican vote against DeVos, and Mike Pence will be the tiebreaker. That said, if DeVos does end up being our Secretary of Education, she has been greatly weakened in terms of being able to, push through some radical vision. She does not have a mandate, as is obvious. This has never happened that the Secretary of Education has gotten so many no votes.
Heather McGee is our guest for All Things Political this hour. She's president of DEMOS, as well as DEMOS Action, a policy research and advocacy organization, both of them working for an America where we all have an equal say in our democracy and an equal chance in our economy. She is no stranger to television. She has done a lot of appearance on Meet the Press, and she's been on MSNBC, Real Time, with Bill Maher. She also served as co-chair of a task force with Americans for Financial Reform. It helped shape key provisions of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. We're talking about executive orders, about what's happening with the courts on the lifting of the travel ban by the Seattle federal judge last Friday night. By 6 o'clock tonight, the government has to have their defense of the ban before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We'll talk about where that goes, and we're looking at all kinds of other issues as well, and welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Back to you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, back to phone calls for Heather. Let's go to Sharon in Waukesha. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. I am so appreciative of the articulation of your guest and things that I so much agree with. But my particular concern is not so much the representatives who were put in by the Tea Party in Congress, but people like Paul Ryan who have, they're betraying us. We've put our faith in them for years, and we're being betrayed. What is this about? Mm. That's all I have to say.
All right. Thanks, Sharon.
That is a really good point. I think this was clear to many of us in the run-up to the election with all of the different signs that we saw that, as a candidate, Donald Trump was so outside of the norms and values that Americans aspire to have as our highest ideals, that it was a real test for the Republican Party about whether or not they would put their party ahead of their country. What we've seen in the first just 2 weeks of refusal to release his tax returns, to divest from companies, the incredibly unnerving and possibly, frankly, possibly treasonous connection with the Russian government using all kinds of tactics, warlike tactics, to be able to influence our election to put Donald Trump in office, and the very disturbing comments that we heard in the past few days from the president about Vladimir Putin and about our relative moral authority to Russia. There's, in addition to the likely illegal and unconstitutional Muslim ban, there are so many reasons why Republicans, most of them who are outside of office, John Yoo, who is no favorite of mine, he was a Berkeley law professor who wrote the torture papers justification for George W. Bush at the Office of Legal Counsel, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times today saying that even he is concerned about the grab of executive authority by this president. This is a moment for all Republicans to ask themselves if they love the power that having a Republican in the White House gives them more than they love this country. And people like Paul Ryan, who at every step of the way had to apologize for or reject comments that candidate Trump made, I'll have to ask the question, are they going to be the party of Bannon, the party of authoritarianism and extremism, or are they going to be a party that is defined by higher ideals? I was on a Meet the Press panel with a conservative, prominent Republican strategist right before the election, and this was after the Access Hollywood tapes disclosed that terrible sort of disclosure by Donald Trump about how he treats women and the impunity with which he can do it. And he looked at me when this Republican strategist looked at me when the cameras turned off and we went to commercial break and said, I think the Republican Party is over and I don't know what I'm going to do about it. And it really struck me because I personally am a Democrat, but I don't want the Republican Party to be over. I want there to be a multi-party system where we each contest for what we think the right future for the country is. But in many ways, what we're seeing now from Donald Trump is an acceleration of trends that have been very ugly that Republicans have allowed to fester within the party for expediency's sake. And it is really a test of character of the current leadership for when they are going to finally stand up.
Heather, you mentioned just a little while ago the possible Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. What's happened with those investigations? This story has really disappeared for a while now.
I think that's frankly been part of the strategy of the administration to do a little bit of shock and awe and keep the media and members of Congress distracted with a new scandal or crisis or outrageous nomination or event or executive order every day so that we lose sight of the fundamentals that were already, at a sort of crisis level before even the president was sworn in. There is movement afoot. Unfortunately, honestly, the House and the Senate, which are both controlled by Republicans, are going to have to determine just how aggressive and real any kind of investigation into what we already know from unanimous national intelligence findings is unprecedented Russian interference in favor of Donald Trump. The question is, with the aides that we know who have been working in Russia, like Paul Manafort, with some of the cables that may or may not have been intercepted, just how much did the president's staff or the president himself know that they were going to be benefiting from these acts of cyber war?
Mm-hmm. And what about the press? Do you know anybody who's really digging into this story? Is it Carl Bernstein?
Well, I will say that one of the great things, I don't know of any particular reporters because I think, we are at the investigation phase right now, but I will say that one of the exciting things about this moment is that the press has sort of shaken itself out of the slumber and the sort of crouch they may have been in as the industry was in such upheaval over the past few years in terms of the kind of finances of so many newspapers shutting down and many investigative reporters being laid off. You're seeing a lot more outlets really staff up their investigative reporting, really encourage and make public, this is how you contact us if you have information. They understand that the Fourth Estate is our watchdog as citizens of this country, and that they have a responsibility to keep the focus on the things that really matter.
Sharon, thanks for your call. We go next to Nate in Milwaukee. Hello, Nate.
Hi, thanks for having me. And I would say that currently I would not look to Paul Ryan as a source of, I would say, principled resistance or something along those lines. Because I see a lot of Republicans basically trying to go along. And if you're, in addition to that, talking about increasing Democratic representation of people, you've got governors and state-level governments. And Wisconsin's not the only one, but right now we have a situation where our state legislature has been so heavily gerrymandered that the people in office are not necessarily paying as much attention to the population as a whole as to their own political party. And it's basically a series of rigged internal party rigged elections in favor of that party. And we're currently got a lawsuit you might want to look at, but it's certainly a national issue in terms of the number of states that this impacts. And then how do you bleed upwards to interacting with the higher up level people like Trump?
I agree with Nate that we are experiencing and have been. Demos is an organization that focuses on economic inequality, the loss of good jobs, the fact that families are running in place in order to make ends meet, and some really common sense solutions to address them, and what has happened over in our democracy over the course of a generation, both the incredible just mushrooming of money, of big money by very wealthy and powerful and well-connected people who capture the attention of the people who are supposed to be our elected representatives in state houses and in Washington, and the fact that there have been these barriers thrown up to the right to register and vote freely. And the redistricting process has also become politicized, as Nate mentioned. You know, democracy is not promised. It is, in fact, a pretty radical and bold idea, the idea that we would have a say in the decisions that affect our lives, and that say would be an equal say, regardless of our background or political orientation, race, class, or gender. And so I think what we are all in many ways in this country waking up to right now is that we have to actually fight for that democracy. And when you see a political party deciding that it wants its politicians to choose its voters and not its voters to choose its politicians, getting into office and then enacting laws to shut the door to the franchise behind them and say, too bad, you can no longer vote me out of office because I'm going to effectively make it impossible for you to vote by adding restrictions. I'm going to change my district so that I am choosing exactly who the voters are who get to vote for me, and making the partisan makeup of my community, of my state, unrepresentative of the communities in it. Should be a call to arms for all of us, that we have to take democracy much more seriously. And I think this moment of unprecedented mobilization and civic engagement, people finding the town halls that are planned for the February recess and being willing to go and take time out of their days to do that is a very good sign.
Thanks, Nate. Jim in Hayward is next. Hi. Oh, wait a second. Hold on a second, Jim. I got something wrong with my phones. There we go. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
I would just like to, I don't agree with everything President Trump does, but on the travel ban issue, you know, the first priority of the president is to protect America and its citizens. So, by having a ban, if it could prevent one person's life from being lost, isn't it worth it? And then another thing I would like to add is the people that are against the ban, if something were to happen to them or their family members, you know, what would their views be then? And then the last thing is I'm assuming that the terrorists that attacked the Twin Towers went through the vetting process.
Heather.
I am... as someone who lives in New York, I'm deeply sympathetic to the threat of international terrorism all the time. I do think that it is the highest priority, not just of a man who's been put into office, you know, 2 weeks ago, but also to the entire national security structure and our military to keep us safe. And the fact is that the process that has been in place has kept us safe from the attacks from refugees, right? This is refugees and visa holders from these countries, which have not been the site of any attacks in the country. And so you have to wonder, what actually is the aim? Why didn't they go for the places, target the places where there have been terrorists who have come and spilt blood on American soil? If we could trust that the actual rationale for this ban was the most evidence-based way to keep us even safer than we are today, then I would say absolutely, in consultation with national security and the intelligence forces, the president should continue to innovate around improving our systems of who comes, who goes, both in terms of visitors and in terms of refugees. But so much about the way that this ban was targeted based on religion, was targeted, the countries that were excluded and included, gives me reason to think that there was something a lot less something in mind that was not just about what is going to most keep us safe.
Thank you, Heather, so much for being with us. Heather McGee, our guest with Demos. I thank very much Scotty Myers for producing this hour and Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow we'll have a supporter of the Trump executive order on immigration.